Honorable Justices, may I please report, my name is Gary Peterson, I'm here from El Paso County. I'm here to present the case of Robert L. Jones versus Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. Very briefly, the primary matter that is of interest this morning is whether or not an intervening workman's compensation carrier is entitled to a portion of, or in fact all of, the prejudgment interest, which may have been awarded either by settlement or by jury in this particular case, to the injured employee in a third-party action. Very quickly, the background of this case is as follows. Robert L. Jones was employed. He was injured in an automobile accident and filed suit against the tortfeasor, Mr. Medford. He was hurt on the job, and as a result of that, Liberty Mutual, the respondent in this matter, of course, paid him certain weekly benefits as well as medical expenses which he incurred. As I mentioned, they being Liberty Mutual, did in fact intervene in this particular cause. The case was tried to a jury, and I would point out that the workers' compensation matter pending between the parties, Jones and Liberty Mutual, was not resolved at that time. That is, that the weekly benefits were continuing to be paid by Liberty Mutual, as well as the ongoing medical expenses. Be that as it may, the jury awarded the sum of approximately $438,000 to Mr. Jones for his injuries. Those awards included, of course, past medicals, an award for past loss of earning capacity, awards for past physical impairment and past mental anguish and pain, and of course additional future awards for those types of damages. It was stipulated at the trial level between Mr. Jones and Liberty Mutual that at that point there was approximately $35,000 which had been paid by Liberty Mutual to or on behalf of Mr. Jones. Based upon the jury award and based upon the past damages which were awarded by the jury, incorporated into the judgment, there was a sum of approximately $19,000 designated as prejudgment interest. The trial court then granted approximately $12,000 of the $19,000 to Liberty Mutual for payment by way of prejudgment interest on the $35,000 which had been paid and accrued as of the date of trial. The main issues for presentation to the court this morning are as follows. First of all, whether or not there should be any prejudgment interest awarded to an intervening comp carrier. Secondly, whether they must specifically plead for and ask for prejudgment interest, or whether they can just adopt by reference the plaintiff's pleadings and come in the door that way. And then lastly, although not specifically raised by this particular case that's currently before you, is how in fact do you calculate those amount of damages. And I mention this last element only because there has, at the same time my case came up, there was another case, Mosley versus the Highway Department, which is also up here, I believe, on an application for writ of error. And in that particular case, the Court of Appeals held that the proper method for determining damages would be for the insurance company and or the parties or the court to make a specific calculation with regard to determining prejudgment interest based on each and every weekly payment. A very laborious method, but of course the court felt that although laborious, it is possible to have done that, and that appears to be the reasoning as to why that particular Court of Appeals instructed the parties to calculate prejudgment interest in that fashion. In my case, by the way, it was merely a fact that there was $19,000. The court calculated what the prejudgment interest would be in the total amount paid, regardless of when it was paid. So court, under Tabner, which was obviously controlling at the time, the calculation method used to determine that the insurance carrier was entitled to $12,000 would be 180 days after the date of the occurrence, and then you started your 10% compounded daily running at that particular point, regardless of when the actual benefits were paid. I would, by the way, before I really get into argument, and I'll try to keep it very brief this morning, I'm sure you've heard that before, I would like to give credit to my colleague, Mr. Mike Patchell, who has also presented the application for for a writ of error here with regard to the Mosley versus Highway Department case. There are some, I think, some appropriate quotes in there, and I would like to give him credit for those at the outset, because I will be referring to some of those quotes throughout the course of my presentation this morning.
You're referring to Mike Hatchell as your colleague, in the sense that anybody who's a member of the bar would be your colleague.
Well, let me be a little more specific. Anybody that's on my side in this particular case, I would consider my colleague. But you're right. I'm not associated with him. I believe he's from Tyler, and I'm from El Paso, so we're miles apart. But I do say that in that vein only. The real question which is of issue here is whether or not the comp carrier is entitled to prejudgment interest based upon some common law right that is as a matter of equity, or in fact is this recoupment that it is entitled to strictly statutory and falls under the Workers' Compensation Act, and that being 8307-6A. That particular statute, of course, reads basically as follows. It says that the net amount recovered by such beneficiary, in this case Robert L. Jones, from the third party action shall be applied to reimburse the association, in this case Liberty Mutual, for past benefits and medical expenses. And then it goes on to say how any excess shall be applied towards any future amounts which Mr. Jones might be entitled to under the workers' compensation. That is the statute that's really in question here. The case law all seems to indicate, and this goes back to some of the cases cited by the petitioner in this particular matter, as well as Mr. Hatchell, obviously says that the workers' compensation statute is to be strictly interpreted. However, it goes on to say that it is to be liberally construed in favor of an employee. And that, of course, is in accordance with a recent decision by this court and a confirmance of other prior decisions, particularly addressed in the Navarrete case at 706 Southwest 2nd, 309. What the court is saying is that we have a statute, and I believe it's we have a statute that addresses the rights of workers under workers' compensation. The long list of cases says that is to be strictly construed. But when there is a question, it is to be liberally construed in favor of the employee so that the employee derives all the benefits to which he is justly entitled. Now, the argument of the insurance industry, and I assume Liberty Mutual in this particular case, is that as a matter of equity, the insurance company, since they have paid the funds up front, they should be receiving the prejudgment interest that is, in fact, awarded in that. I would, and again, I do not try to put words in Mr. Martinez's mouth before he's up here, but I believe that's the basic premise upon which they are presenting their claim. They say that as a subrogee, as a right of subrogation, they should be entitled to all those things which we as the plaintiff would be entitled to, particularly prejudgment interest. I feel that analogy is erroneous, primarily, or at least firstly, for the fact, for this particular fact, and that is that the way I would interpret it, the rights of insurance companies were governed not necessarily by equity, but by contract first, and secondly, by statute, not necessarily in that order. But they're governed not as a matter of equity, but as a matter of contractual obligations between the insurer by way of statutory obligations as created by the legislature. And really, equity, although I'm reluctant to say this, I'm not sure equity lies really on behalf of a particular insurance industry or particular carrier. I feel that it's contractual. I feel that it's statutory. Now, I would further point out that this is not a true matter of subrogation, as the respondent might possibly lead this court to believe. Why do I say that? There's a list of cases, and Mr. Hatchell again cites some of these. One of them in particular is the Ricketts case at 138 Southwest 2nd, 725. And that case basically says that one is not entitled to subrogation. He pays an obligation for which he is primarily obligated. The argument being that associations, workers' compensation carriers, are obligated to pay those benefits under the Workers' Compensation Act. And therefore, it's not a matter of coming in under some type of common law subrogation right, but rather it is a right that is derived specifically from 8307, which says they have a right to recoup from the injured employee if he gets it from the tortfeasor, past benefits, including the weekly and the medical. And then it also says, and associated cost, or costs associated therewith, i.e. attorney's fees. The carrier goes on to argue that they would be entitled to it under cabin. And I would, of course, take issue with that general premise. I think that when this court rendered the cabin decision, it was indicating that prejudgment interest would be available in two types of situations. One where it's created by statute, and secondly, where the general principles of equity would require that it be given. In the Kavner situation, of course, and I hope I don't need to rehash all the reasons for Kavner, but when you have an injured plaintiff and that person walks out in the street and gets run over by a car, there's no real statutory, much less contractual obligation between the tortfeasor and the party. And of course, one of the reasons that this court voiced for its decision in Kavner was with regard to making the plaintiff whole, compensating him for that delay in receiving the funds to which he or she might be justly entitled versus the time period that it actually takes to get your day in court and have judgment rendered. And that was, I believe, one of the primary considerations. And that is why, as I believe a somewhat arbitrary figure of 180 days was picked at that point, go your 180 days and then start your interest running, because it is a matter of equity that nowhere in our statutes was it ever addressed. This is not the case when you have a workers' compensation situation. It is addressed under 8307. And of course, now under one of the tort reform bills that came through, of course, we have it codified in 5069 with regard to who is entitled to actual prejudgment interest. And I'll get back to that in just a moment. I don't think that Kavner applies. I don't think that Kavner, when I say applies, it does not apply to comp carriers. I do not believe that the comp carrier would, had it brought the action in its own name. If Robert L. Jones had opted just to pursue his remedies under the Workers' Compensation Act, that the comp carrier could have brought an action against the tortfeasor and gotten anything other than past medicals and the past weekly benefits and cost of collecting the same. I do not believe that this court would have stretched it so far as to say that insurance carrier could also collect on the prejudgment interest. As I mentioned to you, of course, prejudgment interest has now been set forth by statute under 5069. I think it's interesting to note that the carrier talks in his response to my application for writ of error about legislative intent. And yet, although the legislature has now met, I believe, twice since the Kavner decision, nowhere and in no time has the legislature taken upon itself to change 8307-6A. It hasn't said anything in there about now carriers are entitled to prejudgment interest on those amounts. And I think that is something that, of course, this court needs to take cognizance of, because what I believe we're trying to do is interpret the intent of the legislature. And if they, in fact, intended for comp carriers to get the prejudgment interest, why didn't they say so? Furthermore, when the legislature has now, in fact, enacted an amendment to 5069 and talks about prejudgment interest, and it specifically states the situations and scenarios and methods of calculation for prejudgment interest. Again, nowhere in there does it say anything about insurance companies or comp carriers being entitled to any of that prejudgment interest.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Aside from the statutory construction, what policy reason can you give for awarding prejudgment interest to one who's not out the money?
Justice, if I could please...
Just give me a fairness reason, an equity reason, what in our human experience would cause us to give interest to somebody other than the one that put the money out?
I'm not trying to beg the question.
It's okay. I just, whatever your answer is, it's fine.
My answer would be to answer that in reverse. What effect would it have on, for example, settlement of cases if the opposite were true? And the reason I say that is if a comp carrier comes in, of course, I don't know what percent, let's just say 90 or 95% of the cases are settled. And if you have a plaintiff and you have a tortfeasor and they're trying to settle their cases, and the workers' compensation carrier gets in the middle of it and demands a prejudgment interest, what effect does that have on settlement? If in fact, and you can come up with all sorts of hypothetical questions, and I know I'm supposed to be answering and not asking, but let me just mention a few of those. What if a jury never awarded any settlement for past medicals or any lost past earnings, and strictly past physical impairment in their language? Would a comp carrier then be entitled to interest on its medical amounts that it's paid and its, and in effect, its lost past earnings? What if a plaintiff did not plead anywhere for prejudgment interest and on the award is not given any, but yet has to recoup to the insurance carrier past medical benefits and past weekly and past prejudgment interest? What if, for example, workers' compensation benefits amounted to, say, $20,000, and based on that, there was $5,000 in prejudgment interest earned thereon? So you have $25,000 that the comp carrier is saying he's entitled to. Well, let's say a jury were to award a total of $23,000. Now, the way I understand it, the injured employee would have to give the comp carrier all $23,000. Then the question arises, does that extra $3,000 cover, is that considered advanced payments towards extra, or is that in fact then going to raise the issue of, does that carrier now have to then start picking up again weekly benefits and or medical payments? I think the actual response to your question is that when we talk about fairness and we talk about equity, again, my response to that would be, and I say this not tongue-in-cheek, honestly, but I say that I think my response to that would be that we're not talking here about matters of equity as they pertain to an insurance carrier, but rather as they, those rights are created, by, again, by statute, by contract. And I guarantee, I don't guarantee, but I would presume that when the attorney in the Morgan case, when the Standard Fire insurance attorney stood before you and argued that Ms. Morgan was not entitled to any interest on the $6,000 that his insurance company did not pay her for those periods of 4 years or however long it was, that he didn't see that being as a question of equity, that he saw that as a question of statutory rights and those rights alone. And I think it's hard to argue both sides of the fence. For that particular case, for example, I think points out something very realistic. The statute says, 8306, heard in portions, says that the employee can get prejudgment interest only in the past weekly amounts, but only at 4%, not the 10% compounded date. And she can get nothing on the past medical expenses that she has had to pay out of her pocket. And again, I'm sure the argument to you was it's not a question of equity, it's a question of statute. And that's argument coming from, I would assume, the insurance industry in that particular case. I honestly do not have an answer for you. I think that, in effect, if you're talking about fairness and equity, and if, in fact, the industry were to come under those particular guidelines, there may be a point, and I would concede that. My argument to you is that they don't come under those particular guidelines, again, because it's contractual and statutory and not as a question of equity. And again, I would point out that Kavner only really created prejudgment interest, and it specifically pointed out that they're doing it because, one, there's no statute, and two, there's a general principle of equity. Here we have a statute, and the legislature, in its wisdom, has deemed what it is that an insurance company is supposed to recover and limited it, and has made no change in that. And although I'm sure I haven't answered your question, that would be...
I think you answered it fine, thank you. What I got out of your answer is the legislature never considers equity.
Well, maybe it pertains to insurance companies, but I'm not sure about it. I don't know. I'm not sure what they consider, and I'm not sure what all went into that tort reform. This was an issue, of course, that's been raised for some time now, and apparently wasn't addressed.
Do you believe that the result that you're arguing for was within the contemplation of legislative intent?
I believe that the absence of any reference to the right of an insurance company to get prejudgment interest, particularly in light of the fact that these matters were already raised, by its conspicuous absence, yes, I think it indicates legislative intent. Yes, sir. This may be a situation that, on one hand, I'm tempted to say maybe short-lived, because, of course, now we do have 5069 and the enabling statute, which creates prejudgment interest and specifies it. So this particular case, I'd be tempted to say, could apply only to a very few cases such as mine that's currently there. We're caught in between Kavner and the new statute. On the other hand, if it's not, if it's a situation where this is a decision that's going to be applicable even under statute, forget equity, even under the statute, then we're going to create even more problems. Why do I say that? Well, one reason is that under the Tort Reform Act addressing prejudgment interest, it talks about a tolling period. And the court on its own, the trial court on its own, can consider delays. Well, whose delays are they going to consider? If the insurance company, as an intervener, delays, is the court going to now have to somehow plug that into this formula? If the settlement offer is extended by the defendant to the plaintiff, and that tolls the interest running for that period of time, and let's say that plaintiff chooses not to accept it, and then he doesn't get the interest on that amount that was offered, assuming that the award is granted. How does that affect it? You would have such a variable of formulas and factors that would have to be plugged into that formula that it would be almost impossible to determine the amount. And this is just a practical aside. It really, as far as the issues that are currently before you, but I'm bringing it up only because I think the court obviously needs to be aware of the impact of its decisions, as I'm sure you are, on what's going to happen in the future. And if, in fact, a plaintiff were to be awarded no amount of prejudgment interest, if, in fact, there was a structured settlement or something, well, let's take a structured settlement that he didn't have the cash at hand, how did he repay? All of those things come into effect. And again, I think for those reasons, and in the interest of encouraging settlement between litigants, then I think it's imperative that this court leave spelled out by statute what it is that the account carrier is entitled to. Let me just very briefly touch in closing here on two other matters which were raised. And one is the pleadings. As part of my point of error, I pointed out that at no time did Liberty Mutual ever make specific requests for prejudgment interest. It, quote, adopted by reference all the allegations in the plaintiff's petition. They have alleged, in fact, the Court of Appeals has told me that, well, you should have specially accepted that. I question that because, particularly in light of the Bedore case and some of the more recent ones, which said that you must specifically ask for prejudgment interest.
That's a neat little East Texas town named Bider.
Well, okay, I tried to maybe put some Mexican-American in that for me when I pass it to the term now. But the Bider case, if you have to ask for it, they did ask for it. All they said is we adopt by reference. Well, we were asking for mental anguish, we were asking for physical impairment, all those things which they obviously wouldn't be entitled to. But they say that because they asked for it and adopted our pleadings by reference, that they're entitled to everything that we're entitled to. Now, frankly, I don't believe that. If, in fact, if you took it a step farther and a plaintiff asked for all other relief to which he may be justly entitled, either law or equity, that general language, a defendant doesn't have to come in and specially accept to that particular type of language and say, no, Judge, we're not sure what they mean by all other relief, so on and so forth. And I think the same type of argument could be made here. No pleadings, therefore they're certainly not entitled to it. And as a matter of statutory interpretation, and is a matter that I think has been ruled upon with regard to the issues and the interpretation, the liberal construction of the workers' compensation statute they're not entitled to. As Mr. Hatchell, I think, so astutely points out, if this is the insurance industry's interpretation of liberally construed, which is what they're arguing, they want it liberally construed, and if somehow that goes to the benefit of the employee, please spare us any more charity of this type. That's what he says, and I think I would have to agree with him on that. And the only last issue, again, is how you calculate it. Again, that's not really included in this particular case that's presently before the court. It is addressed in Mr. Hatchell's case, and I think that is also something that, of course, should be looked at by this court. That would conclude my opening unless there are any further questions.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We will now hear argument from respondent.
May I please inform Mr. Antonio Martinez who will present argument for the respondent.
May I please record? I am Antonio Martinez with the firm of Edward Felton and Fern El Paso, and I am representing the respondent in this case, Liberty Mutual Insurance Company, which intervened in the trial court. This application arises from a suit filed by the petitioner against Henry Ed Medford III and El Paso Legal Freight Company, Incorporated. Petitioner sustained a personal injury and an automobile accident which occurred on August 25, 1982. The respondent intervened in the suit in order to recover sums which it had previously paid to or on the behalf of the petitioner as workers' compensation benefits and medical expenses. After a trial by the jury, the trial court rendered its judgment in favor of petitioner. Out of the sums awarded to petitioner, respondent was awarded reimbursement in the total sum of $47,744.97 for the workers' compensation benefit and medical expenses previously paid by it to or on behalf of the petitioner through March 30th, 1987. Respondent was further awarded pre-judgment interest in the amount of $12,225.93. The respondent submits that the Court of Appeals correctly sustained the ruling of the trial court awarding respondent pre-judgment interest on the sum which it had previously paid to or on behalf of petitioner as workers' compensation benefit and medical expenses. The intent of Article 8307, Section 6A, Texas Civil Statute Annotated, is to allow an insurance carrier to recover any money advanced to an injured worker from a third-party tortfeasor. It would be unequitable to allow an injured worker to receive benefits from an insurance carrier and also recover a judgment from a third party for the same benefit which the injured worker has already received from the insurance carrier. Under this scheme, the worker would be obtaining a double recovery for the same injury. Article 8307, Section 6A, prevents this type of inequity and gives the insurance carrier the right to be subjugated to the right, plural, of the injured worker. Article 8307, Section 6A, thus gives the insurance carrier the opportunity to make itself whole through whatever common law rights the injured worker may have against a third-party tortfeasor.
Mr. Martinez, even assuming you're correct here in your argument, you did not plead for prejudgment interest, did you?
Your Honor, prejudgment interest was pled indirectly by the adoption of the petitioner's plea through our opinion of intervention.
Do you think that satisfies the requirements this court has laid down in Benavides? Vider Walgreen and several other cases which we NRE.
Your Honor, the better practice would be to specifically plead for the prejudgment interest. However, the fact that the prejudgment interest was adopted by reference should still allow the intervener to recover the prejudgment interest in this case. Prejudgment interest was awarded. It's just a matter of how it could be divided up between the intervener and the petitioner.
Is it a question of how it's going to be divided up or whether it should be divided?
Whether it could be divided up.
I thought so.
Counsel, let me ask you an equity question also.
Yes.
If the carrier's paid out benefits for which they have contracted and they obviously believe that they're liable because they paid them, where is the equity in letting them recoup back part of the benefits that they were contractually obligated to pay in the first place by collecting interest?
Your Honor, it's the insurance carrier that is actually out of pocket for the money which it has paid for both the compensation benefits and the medical expenses.
But they had to pay that anyway.
That's correct. Yes. But they're being given the opportunity to recoup that through the right of the injured employee to have the third party defendant towards people. And if the insurance carrier is being subjugated to those rights, then if the injured employee is entitled to prejudgment interest, then put them into the shoes of the injured employee, the insurance carrier should also be entitled to those prejudgment interests.
You will concede with me that the statute does not authorize prejudgment, and I'm talking about Article 8306, that's sick, does not authorize prejudgment interest for subrogation, does it?
Your Honor, it doesn't prohibit it either.
Well, then let's talk about the analogy between this case and Standard Fire versus Morgan. The statute does not prohibit prejudgment interest for medical expenses, but it doesn't expressly allow it. Is that not correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, and didn't this court say in Standard Fire versus Morgan that because the statute did not allow for prejudgment interest for medical expenses under the compact, that they weren't, prejudgment interest was not recoverable? Isn't that what we said in Standard Fire versus Morgan?
Well, the court also said in Kavner that even though prejudgment interest is not specifically addressed in some statutes, that this court will allow prejudgment interest.
Except in Standard Fire versus Morgan, we were dealing specifically with the workers' comp statute. Chief Justice Hill, in his opinion for the court, said that all relief was derived from the statute and distinguished that from Kavner, didn't he?
I'm not really sure.
Well, why should you be treated any differently since the statute does not authorize prejudgment interest for subrogation? Why should you be treated any differently than the injured employee who is denied prejudgment interest on medical expenses simply because the statute does not specifically authorize it?
On this particular case, the injured employee was awarded prejudgment interest for medical expenses. On some that
on the,
paid
under the comp payment?
On some that was paid out by the comp carrier.
You sure of that? That the comp carrier in this case, the underlying case, we're not talking about this third party case here, but that in the underlying case, the comp carrier paid prejudgment interest on the medical expenses?
No, I'm talking about the underlying case against the third party. Prejudgment interest was recovered against the third party.
Go ahead.
Article 8307, section 6A, does not place any restrictions on the type of rights to which the insurance carrier is subjugated to. Specifically, it does not state that the insurance carrier is subjugated to the rights of the injured worker except the rights of prejudgment interest. Article 8307 states in part, if compensation be claimed under this law by the injured employee or his legal beneficiary, then the association shall be subrogated to the rights of the injured employee. To allow an injured worker to recover prejudgment interest from a third party on money which was advanced by the insurance carrier would allow the injured worker to receive a windfall in the form of overcompensation. The intent of Article 8307, Section 6A, is to allow the insurance carrier to make itself whole if possible. If under applicable common law, making a party whole includes the recovery of prejudgment interest, then the insurance carrier should be allowed to make itself whole and should be allowed to recover prejudgment interest.
Counselor, in this case, was the damage issue broken down into medical expenses, lost wages, lost earning capacity, and pain and suffering, mental anguish, etc. in the past?
Yes, sir.
Well, now, are you arguing that since you contracted with the injured worker to compensate him for lost earning capacity, period, plus medical expense, that your subrogation right goes to recover for his mental anguish and pain and suffering for which you did not pay?
No, I'm specifically stating that we would be entitled to recover on the payments that we made for compensation and medical expenses.
Now, hadn't the position of the insurance industry since the Workman's Comp Act had been in effect be that if that party recovers $25,000 stolen from the third party and you paid $25,000 in comp, you're entitled to every penny of it?
That's been the position of the insurance companies, and I think that's the way most of the cases have ruled also.
Well, now, you started your argument on an equitable basis. You're entitled to be paid prejudgment interest on the money you paid. Are you arguing that it is equitable for you to pay the injured workman only for his lost earning capacity in medical and yet turn around and recover not only for lost earning capacity in medical but for mental anguish, pain and suffering that you didn't pay him for in the first place?
Well, it's an attempt to try and recoup the money that has been paid out on behalf of the injured worker. If for some reason the recovery is less than the amount that was paid out, Section Article 8307, Section 6A, specifically states that that will be applied to the money that has been paid out. Anything in excess of that, that will be paid over to the injured employee.
Well, aren't you sort of arguing if you win on both sides here? You win if the recovery is not enough for you to recover out of lost wages and medical expense. If there's any excess for other reasons, you went on that. And then on the other side, you pay out, you get prejudgment interest.
Well, I submit that if an insurance carrier can go in and convince a jury that it's entitled to no pain and anguish, it should be able to prove up the actual amount that it had spent on the compensation and medical expenses. Therefore, if it recovers those expenses, then any recovery on mental pain and anguish should be above and beyond what the insurance carrier has paid out.
You lost me on the first statement there. The insurance company, surely, they don't submit any element of damage. All they say, here's what we paid, now I don't care what the judgments are, we get it. And that's
well,
your position?
You know, I'm talking in cases where the insurance company will go on its own and bring the action on its own or in the name of the injured employee.
Gary gets a little
little more than its share if you don't return the premiums paid, because the premiums were paid for you to take care of that worker if he got hurt. It would seem to me that in order to, under your argument, to make it completely just, once you've got a total recovery, you'd have to return the premiums.
Well, in attempting to try and obtain the total recovery, it would in effect keep the premiums down and reduce the burden of insurance on both the employer and pass on, of course, to the general public of the state.
When would you have your prejudgment interest start running? 6 months after the date of the injury, giving rise to the workers' comp claim?
Well, when the court, the governor, indicated that it would pick the arbitrary date of 6 months from the date of the injury in order to avoid a burdensome task on both the trial court and on the attorneys in the state. However, this is the type of injury that can be actually calculated on a day-by-day basis if necessary. And it could go ahead and be calculated from the time that the first payment is made up to the time the second payment is made, so on, up until the date of judgment, if that's what the court desires. It would be a burdensome task, but it can be accomplished. The intent of Article 8307, Section 6A, is to allow the insurance carrier to make a tough hold if possible. If under applicable common law, to make any party hold and include recovery of prejudgment interest, then the insurance carrier should be allowed to make a tough hold and should be allowed to recover the prejudgment interest. The petitioner has stated the respondent's right to subrogation is a statutory right of subrogation. Respondent agrees with petitioner that Article 8307-6A states that the respondent has a right of subrogation. However, the petitioner has interpreted this to mean that the respondent is somehow subrogated to only some of the rights that the petitioner has against the third-party tortfeasor. And respondent cannot agree with this interpretation of Article 8307-6A. The petitioner would prohibit the respondent or anyone in a like position from ever recovering prejudgment interest, regardless of the amount recovered in a third-party action. If the petitioner's interpretation of Article 3807-6A is followed, then what would happen if a third-party action, any third-party action, the total judgment, including prejudgment interest, was less than the amount advanced by the respondent for payment of compensation and medical expenses. Would the respondent be required to segregate that portion of the judgment which represents prejudgment interest and pay that portion to the petitioner, even though the total judgment is less than the amount advanced by the respondent? Yet in this set of circumstances, isn't the payment of prejudgment interest to petitioner similar, if not exactly, like a double recovery by the petitioner? If Article 8307, Section 6A, is interpreted so as not to allow respondent to recover prejudgment interest, then it would appear that a third-party defendant in a similar situation should be allowed to object to the award of prejudgment interest on the sum advanced by respondent, because it was respondent and not the petitioner who had been deprived of the use of that money. And the principle proposed, the principal purpose for allowing the award of prejudgment interest under Kavner is to fully compensate the party who had been deprived of the use of the money. The right of subrogation given by Article 8307, Section 6A, should conform to the legislative intent of Section 6A, and to the intent of the county. Therefore, Article 8307, Section 6A, should be interpreted so that the respondents be subrogated to all of the petitioner's common law rights, including the right to prejudgment interest. Rule 58 of the Texas Rule of Civil Procedure permits the adoption by reference of statements and any pleading. The respondent specifically adopted by reference the petitioner's original petition. The petitioner should have realized that the adoption of the petitioner's original petition by the respondent included the adoption of the petitioner's prayer for prejudgment interest. If the petitioner believed that the respondent petition was in some manner defective, then the petitioner should have filed a special exception pursuant to Rules 90 and 91 of the Texas Rule of Civil Procedure, which require that a special exception be specific and in writing, followed by an opportunity by the respondent to amend. The petitioner failed to file a special exception in this case. Therefore, the prayer for prejudgment interest in the petitioner's original petition should be considered adopted by reference in the respondent's petition and intervention. In Cather, this court stated that if a judgment provided plaintiff only the amount of damages sustained at the time of the incident, the plaintiff was compensated. The plaintiff had been denied the opportunity to get damages between the time of the occurrence and the time of the judgment.
On the money which it had paid for compensation and medical expenses. There is a logical void in allowing prejudgment interest on lost earnings and medical expenses and then not award that prejudgment interest to the party who incurred those expenses. Logic dictates that because it was the respondent that was denied the opportunity to invest and earn interest on the money which it paid for compensation and medical expenses, then the respondent should be fully compensated and be allowed to recover prejudgment interest on that money. In deciding when the accrual of prejudgment interest should begin in personal injury cases, this court chose not to follow the jurisdictions which allowed recovery of prejudgment interest as of the date the cause of action occurs. The court believes that accrual of interest from the date the cause of action accrued would overcompensate the plaintiff by awarding interest on losses not yet incurred. The respondent asked that the court follow this logic and not overcompensate the petitioner by awarding him prejudgment interest on losses which were not incurred by the petitioner. The court recognized in Cather that there are some who assert that designing a scheme on the award of prejudgment interest is a function that would be best left to the legislature. However, the court stated that it is both necessary and appropriate for this court to modify this area of the law in order to eliminate the existing inequity. The respondent prayed that the court put one more inequity to rest and affirm the judgment of the trial court and the judgment of the court of appeal.
Thank you.
Just very briefly in response, I think it's interesting to note that in the respondent's reply to my application for writ of error on page 4, he sets forth this doctrine. Subrogation is an equitable doctrine which places a person to whom a legal right does not belong in the position of a party to whom the right does belong, whether that right be as a creditor or as a possessor of some other lawful claim. I point that out only because I think the insurance industry would be probably the first to admit, despite assertions maybe the contrary in this response, that they do not have a legal right to that prejudgment interest. And I think that's is basically what they're acknowledging here. There is no legal right. They reference a case talking about an insurance company on a actual subrogation where they were entitled to recover to the extent of payments made under the insurance contract, and they cite that case. And I think that case is a good one because that particular case is saying, yes, insurance company, you can only get what you were obligated to pay under your contractual obligations. Mr. Hatchell also references a case of McAllen State Bank in his application for writ. That one also is applicable with regard to subrogation rights. In that particular case, a bank brought a deceptive trade case action against a third party. The bank's insurance company came in and said, we not only want the money that we paid you, but since we're coming in under your rights, we want the triple damages that you are entitled to also. And of course, the court said, no, no, you're only entitled to what you actually paid by contractual obligation. Justice Ray raised a very interesting question on double recovery. I believe that's the basic premise that he had there. And so as not to be accused of being the Joseph Biden of prejudgment interest paying, let me give credit to this quote right here. Again, this is from Mr. Hatchell. And what he says is, since there is very little equity involved in and hardly a hue and cry from the public for reimbursing workers' compensation carriers for compensation payments and medical expenses made on account of an employer whose fault may have been a companion, if not principal cause of the employee's disability, Section 6A may be seen as primarily concerned with preventing double recovery by an injured employee when he or she pursues a third-party action. And that, Honorable Justice, I believe was the actual intent of the legislature. Let's prevent double recovery by that injured employee. But let's limit it to that. Let's not take it a step further and deprive them of rights which they had as a matter of equity under cabinet. I would also raise, as y'all were talking, I raised another interesting question, and what about this scenario? What if, in fact, the employee own negligence caused 50% of the, or his negligence was 50% of the cause of the accident. What happens then? Does the carrier still get all of its benefits? All of its, the answer to that is the current status of the law would show it. Yes, they get up to the full $25,000 as referenced before. They get it all. Do they also get all of the prejudgment interest on that amount, or do they get half of it? And taking the question about refund of premiums, to make it really equitable, let's give that money back. But to do that, what if the employer, as Mr. Hatchell points out to you, what if he were at fault? What if his cause, if his fault was a primary, if not principal cause of the injuries of the employee, does the carrier then, the insurance carrier for that employer whose fault caused the injuries in question, are they entitled to not only being paid back their benefits, but are they also entitled to the prejudgment interest thereon? I think not. Thank you very much. That's a good question.
Thank you. The court will take a brief...